Hey, Dave. Love you, Dave. Lots and lots and lots. And whole lots.
Thank you. I remember I attended Gigi Pa in Macon last year, and I had a lot of fun with the different events of the dances and the speaker meetings and getting to know people. But what I was most excited about and what I left the most touched with was the old timers panel. I remember the importance. I could just feel the importance of everybody getting up Sunday morning and going in to hear the old timers panel. And there, I heard a lot of wisdom. These people had stayed sober for much, much longer than I had ever dreamed I could. I believe at the time I just had 9 months, and that was pretty much a miracle for me. But to me, these people, I want to live off their experience. My sponsor was sponsored by somebody, his sponsor was sponsored by somebody, and so on and so on. And without that, without their desire to want to stay sober, what would there be for me? I guess to me it's really important, these people that have stayed sober and led the way, so to speak, and kind of passed that on to me. So maybe if I stay sober, I can pass that on to somebody else and hopefully be that important to somebody else someday, to be able to share my experience like these people have, do, and will. So with that, I'd like to introduce Dick S.
Thank you, Dave. My name is Dick, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Dick. Love you, Dick. Lots and lots and lots. And oh, lots.
Thank you. I first want to apologize for my voice. When I was invited here, since I was invited here, I've undergone a little bit of surgery and a lot of radiation for throat cancer, and the prognosis is excellent, but meanwhile, you'll have to tolerate the voice. I brought some notes with me today. You're going to have a real bargain when this is done. There's going to be 22 tapes for $15. I've been in AA for a pretty long time. It's obvious from looking at me I've been somewhere for a pretty long time. I got sober in May of 77. I don't know when in May of 77, so I celebrate May. Unlike many of you, I don't have the advantage of public records. The talk I'm going to give tonight, today, is from my book entitled There's a Reason That Road Is Less Traveled, Stupid. I was told when I came here, I bought some casual clothes, but I was told to wear a jacket and tie. I don't know why. But I happen to make my living as a lawyer, and you caught me casual as I get, really. Usually wear a vest. The story behind that vest, I always knew I was a high bottom drunk because I always had to hold in my silk tie when I threw up. I got around that by wearing a vest. Except the vest created other problems. I used to stagger into the men's room, stumble over to the latrine, open my vest, pull out my tie, and pee in my pants. I got sober in May of 77 at a place called Rebus in Cobb County. I have a law partner. He got sober at the Betty Ford Clinic. I always resented people with material advantages. It always gripe me that he got sober at the Betty Ford Clinic in Palm Springs. I had to get sober at goddamn Rebus. And it griped me for a while till I realized why I did not get sober at the Betty Ford Clinic. It was because when I got sober, Betty Ford was still drinking. But I never let facts get in the way of my resentments. My background is I was an only child for the first 10 years of my life. They say if you have a difficult job to do, you give it to an only child because the thought of failure never occurs to him. I was raised in an Irish Catholic family. I know it's unusual to find Irish Catholics in this program. I was one of those rare Irish Catholics that happened to be an alcoholic. I went through the Catholic school system with flying colors. I was always smart. I always say the college is the same thing. The Jesuits taught me how to think, and I haven't felt safe since. I got a scholarship to law school. I studied courses in philosophy, syllogistic reasoning, you know, God is love, love is blind, Ray Charles is blind, therefore Ray Charles is God. I got a scholarship to law school. I was in a law review. Going through law school, I committed matrimony. I did this in front of witnesses. Matrimony in the first degree is punishable by life. My current wife and I, we've been married 30 years, but I call her my current wife. I find it keeps her on her toes. In 2 weeks, we will be celebrating our 30th wedding anniversary. In May, I celebrate. I did it all myself. We owe the 30-year longevity, contrary to what you'll find in the back pages of Cosmo, we owe the 30-year longevity of that marriage to the fact that we have never, ever had an in-depth discussion. After marriage, my wife tried to keep up with me and drink like I did. Damn near killed herself. She thought we ought to have something in common. We had our first child, and she became a mother and an adult, and I wanted to stay and play with the munchkins. I kept drinking, and of course the marriage had its troubles because of that drinking. Got a job as a lawyer in Hoboken, drank some more. When things looked like they were troublesome up in New Jersey, alcoholics don't have relationships, we take hostages. So I moved my hostages here to Atlanta, my wife and child, and kept drinking. Trouble kept coming. My wife was expecting our second child, Brendan, and I was had some health problems. They thought I had prostate cancer. It turned out I did not. My first experience with humility was submitting to those prostate exams. The only problem was I began to like them. I raised my drinking problems with the urologist because by this time he knew me so well, and he referred me to a psychiatrist. I didn't want to go to AA because I was a professional and I thought I should go to other professionals. And I paid the psychiatrist $90 an hour for the privilege of lying to him. I didn't really lie to him. I told him only as much as I thought he needed to know to help me. Apparently I misjudged. And that went on until May of 77. After a first start in January, I went to AA to get some pamphlets, prove I had been there, get the heat off. Showed up drunk that night, threw the pamphlets on the table and said, "See, the damn thing doesn't work." At first meeting, I got exposed to some people at Rebus. They told me to not drink and go to meetings, and I knew these people were not as smart as I was. I was willing to go to a couple of meetings, but not drinking seemed to be a bit severe. You don't want to be a fanatic about these things. By the time May came along, I had lost the wife, the house, the career, the children, and I went back to Rebus. And this time they had smarter people there. They said, don't drink and go to meetings, and this time it made sense to me, so I did. I began a journey through the steps, and most of what I've come across have been misunderstandings and corrections of my understanding of the steps. That first step said, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. And the first word of that first step was magic for me, because I had never been part of a we. I'd always been on my own. And to me, my alcoholism was a disease of implosion. It got down fewer and fewer things except me and my booze. And then my booze deserted me. And that was, I was truly screwed at that point. I got to the second step, and I said, came to believe that a power greater than myself. And I'm glad it said that, because it doesn't say we came to believe in anything. It said we came to believe that. And I could believe that by watching other people. There was no sense of a higher power yet. The third step had told me to make a decision. And I keep hearing in meetings, and I don't know why, well, I turned it over, and then I took it back, and then I turned it over, and then I took it back, and then, there's no turning it over, taking back in that third step. It just says decide. It's like that pilot told me, a friend of mine, he said, a flight from Atlanta to San Francisco, the plane is on course only 2% of the time. The rest of the time, it's correcting. And that's what that third step is, it's charting the course. Staying as close as you can and correcting as needed. That fourth step for me was I took a searchless and fearful moral inventory that first time. I discovered that at any given point in time, 50% of AA is working on the fourth step. I did that. I wallowed in the fellowship for a while. And my sponsor came to me and said, you've got a lot of anger and resentment, you better take a fourth step. And I didn't think I had any anger and resentments. In fact, it pissed me off when he told me that. I was so smart. I had gotten the big book, I was about 3 weeks over, and I had gone through the big book and made notes in the margin because I had some ideas for the next edition. I want to give the benefit of my thinking. And I may be the only pigeon in the history of the program whose sponsor took away his big book. Fifth step for me was important because it got rid of my secrets. The secrets are what kept me drunk. And it's hard to feel, you really feel you belong after you unburden yourself of those secrets. You don't go around hiding secrets from somebody you've told about the fraternity parties and the booze and the drugs and the women and the small farm animals. I misread that sixth step too. It says we're entirely ready. I always thought it said willing. A lot of people read it willing. It doesn't say willing, it says ready. And ready to me meant nothing more than I had done the first five steps. I'm glad it's ready and not willing, because ready is action. Willing is a state of mind or feeling. And I'd love this to be a program of mind and feeling, but it's not. It's a program of action. And that meant I had to get ready. That seventh step does not say, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings, and he did. I have every shortcoming I had when I got here. It's just that they don't interfere with my drinking, my life anymore. I had a character defect. I just had to exercise it, you know? You told me you didn't like my tie. That gave me the right to burn down your house with your wife and your kids in it. You know? I still have the defects. They just don't run my life anymore. Lust. Well, age is taking care of most of that. I made a list of the persons I had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. And there was a guy I didn't want to put on my list because he was a boss who fired me. And I don't want to put him on my list. You know? He's now a vice president of some company in Chicago. He's really up there giving a damn whether he's on my list or not. You know? Some people tell you, and don't forget to put your own name on the top of the list. More alcoholic egotism coming to the fore. This whole program is about you and correcting you. You need no special attention in that eighth step. That list is for the harm you've done to other people. Nine told me make direct amends. I thought I was going to run around and make apologies to everybody. My sponsor took me aside. As you're a lawyer, what does amend mean? It means to change, right? You don't make apologies, you make changes. If you come home drunk and knock down your neighbor's mailbox, you don't owe him an apology. You owe him a mailbox. I corrected the 10th step. It used to read for me, continue to take personal inventory, and if I was wrong, promptly admitted it. It doesn't say if, it says when. That 11th step, saw it through prayer and meditation. It's the longest and most powerful step for me. And it doesn't say, I thought I'd take the step and I'd know God's will. That's not what it says. It says, gain a knowledge of His will. It's like the difference between knowing somebody and knowing of somebody. And a knowledge of His will for me. I also believe I know it for you, and if you'd see me after the meeting, I can tell you what God's will is for you. But the step just tells us the knowledge of will for me. And the 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result. I misread that too. I thought it was a result, and I'm glad. Because if I came here, as a lot of you did, and I said, if I go to meetings and I don't drink, what will happen to me? Well, you get a spiritual awakening. That would have thrilled the shit out of you when you first got here, wouldn't it? And it says to alcoholics, because this program is for alcoholics. If you read that little red book with the original manuscript that used to read in this original draft, carry the message to others, especially alcoholics. And it narrowed down to make the singleness of purpose of this program. It says to carry the message to alcoholics. Doesn't mean if you have other problems you can't be here. But if one of them is not alcoholism, this program has very little to offer you. There's that singleness of purpose that has kept it here. I have come through the program, carried the message as best I could. I have four children. My calls used to come for me. People talk about the midnight and 1 a.m. calls. Mine used to come at supper time, 5 or 6 o'clock. And 5 or 6 o'clock with four kids in a house was hell. And I'd listen to the guy and try and get the message, try to set him up. He sounded all right. Try to meet him at 7 o'clock and take him to an 8 o'clock meeting. And on the way out the door, my wife would say, hey, well, before you go, can you help me get the kids ready for bed? And trying to get a 2- and 4-year-old to convince that just because they're putting their pajamas on now doesn't mean they have to go to bed right now. Come on, get your pajamas on. Not bedtime. We go to bed later, put your pajamas on now. Come on, my pajamas on, you make me go to bed now. No, you put your pajamas on. I want to go to bed. God damn it, put your pajamas on. Leaving the house, the wife would say, when do you be back? And I said, well, as soon as I give this, then I'll be some of my serenity. My journey has been not much different from others. I got here, I lost the wife, the house, the kids, and I hurt, and I cried, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And when I was 2 years sober, my son, Brendan, we found out he had needed open heart surgery, and he was retarded and would need special care. And I hurt, and I cried, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And when I was 5 and 7 years sober, we had 2 more children, and I shared the joy, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And when I was 8 years sober, I found out my son, Kevin, had cancer, and I hurt, and I cried, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. When I was 13 years sober, he was declared cured of his cancer, and I shared the joy, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And here in my 19th and 20th year, I had been diagnosed with cancer. I was afraid, and I cried, and I hurt, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And in January of this year, my son Brendan, who was 22, was called back by God. And I hurt, and I cried, and I didn't drink, and I went to meetings. And I took from the life of that retarded boy the gifts that God had given me, because I came here so proud of my intellect and how smart I was, and all those degrees on my wall. And here was this retarded boy who brought to me all the things that I didn't have. Brendan went with me last Christmas to see his sister sing in a choir. We went out to listen in the malls where they sing. And as I was sitting there ready to hear it start, I listened to mall music, the pipe music was coming in, and I'm going, yeah, damn, the music is coming here. Why are they doing Turn the music down. These kids are going to sing. And behind me was this electronic game room with the door open and all the noise coming out. And they closed the damn door. These kids are going to sing. These people, can't they make it better? And in the midst of all this, Brendan turned to me and said, "Isn't the singing beautiful?" He was there for what he was there for. And he brought me to see some of the truth. This program doesn't require truth of us. It requires only honesty. And it requires of me only one truth. And that truth is the central operative truth of my life. And it's the truth with which I began my remarks to you this morning. And that truth is that my name is Dick, and I'm an alcoholic.
Thank you, Dick. It is my honor now to introduce the next speaker we have. His name's Gail G. Gail. Sorry. As you see, I just met her this morning, but I had an opportunity to talk to her, and she seems like she has a lot to know about this program. It was an honor to meet her. She has a smile on her face this morning, and I'm not a morning person when I wake up. So to see somebody with a glowing face helped me a lot and soothed me. But I'm excited to hear her story, and I'll let her speak it now. Thank you. My name is Gay Garner, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Gay. Love you, Gay.
And I return that to you 3 times 100. I love your energy and I love your enthusiasm. And I love it because, you know, you are the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. So I feel, as I have many times when I've been in the company of the young people, that we are in good hands. And I hope for each and every one of you that you will be in for the traveling the path as I have been. I am still awed. My sobriety date is March 14, 1976. And I'm still awed at what has transpired in my life since I was given the opportunity to walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. I want to tell you a little bit about my family. I'm really glad to be here. It seems to me that whatever it is about this alcoholism, that my family's got it. I am the granddaughter of an alcoholic. I am the daughter of an alcoholic. I am a mother of an alcoholic who sits in the audience 11 months sober with her sponsor this morning. Lori is my daughter. Lori has been trying to get sober since she was 16 years old. And we had the opportunity to put her where we thought she could get some help. And she obviously wasn't ready. You know, it always works for a while, and then we're left with ourselves. And, of course, I have a friend who says this is the fellowship of the last resort. This is where we come when there's nowhere else to come and there's no other help available. And I'm so grateful. We miss a lot of time together because of alcoholism, and now we're making up for that. And we're doing a lot of traveling together, a lot of AA functions together, and I can't tell you how wonderful that is. And she has a wonderful sponsor who I've had an opportunity to work with in service. And when I called Donna, I said, you know, Lori's, I think, ready to get sober again. And I said, do you know anybody up in that area? She's asked me about a sponsor. Do you know anybody up in that area that could help her? And Donna said, well, I'll be glad to do that. And I said, yeah, but Lori, and she said, but I'll be glad to do that. And I finally realized, you know, I'm in there interfering in God's work again. And so Donna is her sponsor, and I'm very grateful. And it's just how it works here. I also am now the grandmother of an alcoholic. Lori has a daughter who is 14 years old. She is in a treatment facility in Cobb County. She's been there almost a year, and if things go well, she'll come back home in November. So, you know, the disease, the illness of alcoholism just goes on and on. It seems to me that no matter what kind of education we have, which is wonderful because I think it gets us to recovery, but somehow in the big book tells us that, you know, the alcoholism has to run its gamut, and it certainly has in my family. And so I'm grateful for you people, and I'm grateful that when Jessica gets out of the treatment center, that there will be a place that she can go and be with young people and share with young people. that becomes very important to me because it's very obvious to me that the times in which I grew up and the problems in which I had are so different than the world that we live in today. As I'm able to look back over, you know, my life through this wonderful process of inventory, which I'm so grateful for because I am one of these people who would not naturally know how to do this, that I'm able to see a little bit about myself. Oh, I wanted to tell you a little bit more about my family. I'm married to a man who I think the big book terms as a heavy drinker who, given the right set of circumstances, stops drinking. We drank together for many, many years. He came to Al-Anon 5 years when I was 5 years sober, and his life has become as much a miracle as mine has. And together, I'll tell you a little bit about that later in my story, but together we have tried to take the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon into our family. We took a lot of sickness in there for a long time. We take that responsibility. Today we don't do that. Today we take the principles of the steps and we talk to our children about that. It's part of our amends to them. Al is also an Al-Teen sponsor, which he says is part of his amends. He works with children from alcoholic homes. We have three children. Our oldest daughter seems to just have an ability to live life on life's terms. We're not really sure how she got in her family, but she's always had a higher power in her life. I mean, and that's not to say that she hasn't had problems, because life has problems, but she just deals with them well. She knows what to do, she knows where to go, and you know, we've learned a lot from just watching her. And then Lori, our middle daughter, who has been in and out of the program for 18 years, who now is sober 11 months. And then our youngest daughter, who's been in NA for a period of 5 years. She doesn't go to meetings anymore, and I think she may be in some trouble at this time, but she knows where the answer is, and that's a peaceful thing in my heart that she knows where the answer is. As I'm able to look back on my life and the times in which I grew, you know, times were a lot different than they are today. Things were not talked about. Things were not shared. As I look back on my home life, the one thing that I had a wonderful family. We had a lot of money, so there was a lot of opportunities for me. Even though alcoholism was in the family, it was not, we didn't go without anything. There were emotional things that happened a lot, though. And as I look back, the one thing that I remember, and the one thing that I was able to take into my own family, was this silent score and this proverbial shutdown. Whenever things didn't go, when you fell from grace and you didn't know, you know, that you had not done what someone had wanted you to, or they were angry at you, the thing that they did is they just shut down. I mean, they didn't talk to you. And I can remember that horrible loneliness and terrible silence that went on. And I carried that into my own family as I look back. You know, I did a lot of harm. I thought for a long time when you harmed people, it had to be a verbal or a physical abuse. And I learned in my own, after being sober a while, that what damage I did in my silence and my withdrawal of my support and my affection from my children. And I have to watch that today, because that's still, you know, if I get hurt or things go wrong with me, what I want to do is to shut down and just withdraw from my family and those people who love me. So I have to work on that all the time. I lived in a fantasy world. Back then, when I was a kid growing up, movies were wonderful. You know, the guy got the girl, and people sang to each other, and all that kind of stuff. So I lived in the movie theaters, and I just had an idea that life was supposed to be that way. You know, that everybody lived happily ever after. I read a lot of magazines. Unfortunately, they were True Romance and True Confession magazines, and so I thought when you met the soulmate of your life, you would ride off into the sunset and live happily ever after. So that's kind of the mindset that I had. I was an excellent student. I did not run with kids that drank. I did not drink. I never had my first drink to have a drink until I was 18 years old. I had a music ability that got me into a lot of things. As I'm able to look back, it seemed in my life that I was always surrounded by a lot of people. So when I first got to the program and they talked about loneliness and not having people in their life, I didn't identify right away. It was as I began to get more honest and see that I had a lot of people in my life, but I never had an interconnection with anybody. I left Omaha, Nebraska at the age of 18 to go to New York to study music at Juilliard School of Music. I had been with these kids all my life, raised with them, went to school with them, went to Sunday school with them, went to camp with them and everything. I never had a connection with another person. So I left Omaha and never you know, called anybody or wrote anybody or saw anybody. And it's sort of the way my whole life was. There was always seemed to be a lot of people around, but I never knew how to have a relationship with another person. I never had an interconnection. Alcoholics Anonymous has taught me that. And of course, in all of our literature, it says, you know, the cause of a lot of our woes is the inability to be in a lasting and a true relationship. And it's something that AA has taught me. I never knew how to do that. And I went off to New York to study music. And you have to realize this was 40 years ago, so you know what the times were. And I had kind of a naivety and an innocence about me that never served me very well. And I got involved in the music world up there. I'm a jazz pianist, and so I was thrown immediately into the jazz world and working. Things went very well for me. It was to become my first blaming board, but at the time I got there, I saw the situation for many years as going there, studying, becoming very successful, and then my father showing up in New York and taking me home. I had a resentment for him, at him for years because of this situation, and only several years ago saw the truth in this situation. And what had happened is, in the world that I was thrown into in New York City, I was approached several times about joining prostitution rings, and I found it necessary to share that with my mom and dad. And I was also approached many times. Drugs were very prevalent in the jazz world. I was offered a lot of drugs. I shared that with them. And I got involved with a married man. I didn't know he was married at the time, but, you know, got my heart broken and found it necessary to share that with my mom and dad. And next thing I knew, my dad was in New York. And we had one of those little father-daughter talks. And he convinced me that I needed to come home, that that was not the kind of life I wanted. So I was to come home. But it was the beginning of a blaming board when things really did not begin to go well with me. My blaming board was that they just left me in New York and left me alone, you know, to become successful and do what I really wanted to do, I would have been okay. The other thing that happened to me in New York was that I had my first drink. And, of course, the first drunk followed very closely after that. And I was living with a maiden aunt, and I would go home, and I would be very drunk and very sick, and she would ask me what happened to me, and I said I had eaten something that had not agreed with me. Now, the thing about it is significant for me, that and before I even knew I was in trouble with alcohol, I was lying about my drinking. And that pattern of lying was to follow me, you know, until I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I came back. My father had relocated in Winston-Salem, and I came back and went to enrolled in Wake Forest College. At that time, it was run by the Baptist State Convention, and there was not an awful lot of fun things going on the campus. But I immediately found those four or five people who drank and was attracted to them like a magnet. And Al was part of that. Al, my husband, was part of that crowd. And really our education at that particular time then became listening to jazz and going to little jazz spots in Winston-Salem and drinking. I became pregnant. This was another horrifying thing of that period of time. It was not talked about like it is. It was a very shameful thing. My family was devastated by it. I was devastated by it. I realized after being 5 years sober that Al might have been a little bit devastated by it, but you know, that selfishness and self-centeredness of the alcoholic, which I had even back then, was, you know, that I only saw things as they related to me in my life. I never saw, you know, like Al as an individual out there with his own dreams and desires and things. It was just how it related to me. Well, Al was pulled out of law school. The marriage was arranged, and we were married. I don't think either one of us were ever asked how we felt or what we wanted. It was just arranged by us. My parents were devastated. Things were said back there that I carried way into the program that were said in moments of despair and sadness and, you know, what are we going to do, confusion type thing. But I remembered everything that had been said and was not able really to put that to rest until I was several years sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. This was to become my second blaming board. Of course, you know, I'd read all those magazines about true romance and everything, and I just really expected to ride off in that sunset, and the marriage was a disaster. And it seemed like the more we tried to put it together and to get it to work, the worse it got. And I began to really be obsessed with this and trying to make it work. I had been told that marriages under those circumstances did not work, and I was bound and determined to make it work. I think our drinking at that period of time really was just on weekends, and I was not a daily drinker at that time, but there were just a lot of problems and a lot of sadnesses. And, of course, back then you didn't share that kind of things with other people, so, you know, all this stuff just stayed inside and festered. I began to look for things to make me feel better and things to make this marriage work. The drinking began to accelerate, of course, as the sadness began to accelerate. Al had an opportunity to take a job with a famous entertainer. He was in radio, and this man wanted him to set up some radio stations throughout the United States for him and to be his personal manager, and Al agreed to do that. And the first move that we made was to Knoxville, Tennessee. And this was where some things really started in motion for me. I became a daily drinker. It just happened. I just started drinking daily. I think that I did. I think as I look back, I really began to drink differently at this time. I always loved drinking. I always loved what it did for me. As you hear so many alcoholics talk about, but I think at this period of time, I began to drink differently. I began to kill the pain that was going on inside of me. I developed a terrible fear of being alone at night, and I don't know where that came from. I had no experiences to draw that. I was just terrified at nighttime. Al was doing a lot of traveling. I was alone. By now, we had the three children. He reinforced the windows. He put window locks on them for me. He put door locks and all that kind on me. I began to sleep with guns and knives and billy clubs and all kinds of things just because of my fears, my unknown fears, even to the point where I would go and get in bed with my children to feel some sort of a security there. I didn't know how to drive a car. I was almost 30 years old. The drinking had accelerated. Now I'm drinking every day. And my relationship with my husband was so bad that I began to put that dependency back on my mother. I do believe that today I'm a dependent person, but AA has taught me where that dependency is safe for me. And, of course, that's on God and AA as a whole. But at this time, you know, I had always been a kid that always needed that pat on the back, always needed some sort of reinforcement, and my mother gave that to me. She sat around and told me how special I was. So my dependency went right back to her, not being able to put it on Al. And she became my higher power and the most important person in my life. And she came, I didn't know how to drive. I was 30 years old, and it was part of that dependency of expecting everybody to do everything for me and not being willing to do the effort to take care of myself. So she came and taught me how to drive. But I never drove over 25 miles an hour until I got sober. I was absolutely terrified of the automobile. And, of course, now I live in Atlanta, and I drive 285, and I have learned to drive the speed limit and over the speed limit. Now I get a chance to work my program reverse-wise on my driving. But anyway, I'm just a maniac on the road like everybody else is anymore. But anyway, so that's what happened to me at that period of time, and the drinking began on a daily basis, and I began to, the progression of alcoholism began for me. We moved shortly to Augusta and then to Baltimore. By the time we got to Baltimore, I was doing all the things that alcoholics do. I was loading my drinks. I was lying about my drinking, which I had always done. I was buying a liquor by the half pint. I was watering down booze. I was sneaking drinks. I was loading drinks. I was doing all these things. I began to sort of seek out things to make me feel better. And I started reading. Self-help books were coming on the market at that time. And I started reading all those self-help books. And I did all those things that a lot of women do. I, you know, got a new hairdo. And then, you know, my hair all fell out. So I bought a lot of wigs. And got contact lenses, and always had a little bit of a weight problem, so I could always go in that direction, try to, you know, take some weight off. And the insidious thing about it is, you know, for a very short period of time, it will work. And then, of course, once again, you're left with yourself. I never knew till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous what was wrong with me was inside. I never knew what the healing that had to take place inside. I always thought it was outside stuff, as many of us do. And, of course, my sponsor was very quick to point out to me in all these things that where I was seeking some sort of relief and some sort of happiness. There's no first step, so, you know, I can never get there until that drink gets put down. So anyway, life went on for me. Got to Baltimore, Maryland, and I was pretty sick by the time this had done. I had worked professionally as a musician up until this period of time, and we said that the reason I wasn't working anymore was because of the crime in Baltimore, but that was not true. The fact of the matter is I was really into the alcoholism, and I couldn't do it. I was ending up under the piano more than I was ending up at the piano, so it just became a time that I couldn't. And as I look back, too, there was such a lack of gratitude for the gift, such a lack of gratitude that, and I really believe that that was part of why, you know, I just couldn't do it anymore, because I didn't have that gratitude for it. I got a call one Thanksgiving morning that my mother had died suddenly, and my world just fell apart. This was to be my final blaming board. And I started drinking around the clock. There were some things that began to happen to me at this time. My hair all fell out, as I told you. I began to get sores all over my body. I had swellings in my hands and my feet and my throat that was to lead me to a series of doctors trying to find out what was wrong with me. Now, my family had, I had no information about alcoholism. My family had absolutely no information about alcoholism. We all knew I drank too much, but we did not know anything about the illness. I went to a series of seven doctors trying to find out what was wrong with me, and they ran a lot of tests. They kept thinking I was allergic to something, although they never did find out what it was that I was allergic to. Anyway, after they ran all these tests, they called Al and I together, and they told us that I was having a nervous breakdown. And the doctor said to me, "Gay, you're going to have to change. You're going to have to change how you think, how you feel, how you act, how you react. Everything about you is going to have to change if you're going to survive." Now, one doctor questioned me about my drinking, and of course I lied to him about the drinking. The significant thing as I think about that today is, you know, when I walked through the doors of AA, that's exactly what I was told. I was told that I was going to have to change. Everything about me was going to have to change. Well, I asked that doctor, I said, "Well, you know, how do I do that?" And, you know, he gave us one of those looks like, "You ought to know how to do that." And he said, "I don't know. You just have to go out there and change." And when I came into AA and they told me that, I said, "Well, how do I do that? How do I change?" And they said, "We have 12 steps of recovery that will help bring about that change in your life, so that you can live successfully in the world without alcohol." And not only that, but all those wonderful promises and things that do happen to us as a result of getting involved in working the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, so I came away from the doctor knowing that there had to be some change, not knowing any what at all how to do it. Then the curtains really began to close in. I had heard about Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd had a friend that I had visited in Omaha, the husband of my piano teacher, and he had shared his story with me. I never had any idea of the significance of this in my life. I just listened and thought it was really wonderful how he'd really been able to pull his life together, but never realized what he was doing was planting seeds that were to come into fruition as time went on. We got to Atlanta. By the time we got to Atlanta, things were really in a mess. I had all those fears that the alcoholic has. I was absolutely into the despair and the desperation and the hopelessness and the helplessness that happens for all of us. Al's business had been really, had a lot of problems. The FBI had our phone tapped. The IRS had become a regular visitor at our door. Our bank accounts had been attached. They'd taken some of our cars. They'd taken some of our furniture. So there was a lot of legitimate fears that were going on at that particular time. I think that my hitting bottom and starting into recovery is very much described like it is in the 12 and 12. The bankruptcy was complete. I was so self-absorbed with myself and what was going on with me, I could not see anything out. I thought that I had just been dealt a rotten hand in life. I never had any idea that there was a possibility that I could change that. I sat on the bed with a loaded gun getting ready to blow my brains out, because life had become so horrible for me that to be removed from it would have been a relief. I just had that intervention of God, that moment of truth, that act of providence it talks about in that first step. Put the gun down, went, looked in the mirror, saw myself in the mirror. The words that came out of my mouth were, "Oh God, what am I going to do?" And I went to the phone call to Alcoholics Anonymous. By the time they called me back, which I'm sure was not a long period of time, I called the answering service number. I had passed out, and I could not take the call. So one of the children took the call and asked if they could call me back the next morning, and they did, and I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I have been so fortunate. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a housewife alcoholic, so I did not have a lot of bizarre things that had happened to me. So there was a little problem with identification. There were not a lot of women there, so I didn't have that opportunity. And as I look out over the audience and as I go to my meetings and I see the women who sit in the meetings, I'm so grateful that, you know, that is not the way it is anymore. I'm one of those fortunate ones. I have had the same home group and the same sponsor since I've been sober. I had to go to North Atlanta to get her, but you know, when you really want to get sober, you do what they tell you to do. I love the time in which I got sober. It was a wonderful time. There were a lot of old timers there, and the new people didn't talk very much. We really listened a lot more than they do today, and our questions were answered before the meeting and after the meeting, and we really did. We listened to what they had to say. And someone told me about a wonderful group called Clarkston that had just started, and it was a step meeting, second one in the city. And of course, we have so many now, you know, step meetings and big book meetings. But back in those that short period of time ago, we just didn't have that many. So I went to Clarkston, and I heard the old timers talking about the steps, and it was wonderful. And for the first time in my life, I began to find something in life that really worked for me. And I started working the steps. I got a sponsor. The first thing my sponsor suggested I do was go home and pray. And I told her I didn't believe in prayer, that I was sorry, that, you know, I tried all that stuff and that didn't work for me. Of course, I know today when it didn't work for 24 hours, you know, I was looking for something else. I went into a Catholic church one time and lit a candle and said a little prayer, walked out and expected my life to be changed. And it wasn't changed, so I figured it didn't work. So I was looking for something else after that. Anyway, I did what she told me to and went home, went in my room, shut the door, locked it for fear that somebody might see me on my knees praying. And yeah, I can't tell you how uncomfortable it was. It was very uncomfortable, but I did it. She gave me a great piece of freedom. She says, you don't have to believe it if you'll just do it. You don't have to believe it. And that really opened a lot of doors for me. She also told me that I was going to learn a lot of new meanings to a lot of old words that I had heard all my life. And that was true. I thought I was a very well-educated person. I went in and I didn't understand what they were talking about. They were talking about the character defects and love and self-esteem and all those kind of things. And I had absolutely no idea what those words meant. So that kind of gave me the freedom then to not feel real stupid and be able to ask questions. So those were the two things that she really did for me. And but anyway, I went in and I said this little prayer to God that I wanted to stay sober and hope that he would help me, you know, put my life together again. And I came out, and there was no burning bush or lightning or anything, but I know as I look back that my life was never the same from that period of time. And it was the beginning of a conscious contact with God, which is something I'd never had before. It was also a wonderful time to get sober because there weren't a lot of women in the meetings, and when the 12-step calls, I got a chance to go on. So I had many, many years of wonderful 12-step work, which I just think that it is our finest hour, and I'm so grateful to have had the opportunity. And I still get kind of awed at the fact that, you know, this pitiful person who sat on the bed ready to blow their brains out, this sick individual, now is involved in saving lives and helping others. And all that stuff that has been so horrible in my life becomes my greatest asset and my things that I can share with new people so that they don't feel alone and they feel that, you know, they are also where they belong. As I began to get my life together a little bit, you know, all my family began to fall apart. First, when my father had come to live with me, and as I got sober that first year, I watched him die of alcoholism. And after about a year, he decided I wasn't any fun to live with anymore, so he went to Florida, went on a drunk and got sick and ended up in the hospital. And I went down, had a chance to talk with him, you know, about going to AA, and he was going to go, but it was not to be the way it was because he passed away at the hospital. And I was very upset and very angry, and I couldn't understand why, you know, I had been given the grace and he hadn't been given it. And, of course, I came back, and the people in AA once again held my hand until I reached the other side and had a little understanding about what was going on and understanding there, but for the grace of God. And I was able to put that where it needed to be put. And I was able to finally come to some sort of peace with this relationship with my mother and take the good things out of it and work the program, you know, with the rest of the stuff. So that got put in its proper place. We soon learned that Lori was heavily involved in drugs and alcohol, and she became a runaway. A lot of times we didn't know where she was, and it was a very hard time, and it pushed me more into the program. We did find her, and the night that we found her and put her in a treatment facility in Atlanta, I was at my home group at that time, Pat W. had come to my home group. And it was a very difficult time for me to get through. And they asked me to read How It Works, and I cried through the whole thing. But I went to my business meeting that night. You know, we just went to our business meeting back then, you know. Short of death, you were at your business meeting. And anyway, Pat had asked me if I would serve the group at the GSR. And I told him I was real sorry I couldn't do that. I had too many personal problems. I would not be able to be of service. And he took me aside and talked to me, you know, about what service was and what it would do and how good it would be for me. And, of course, being a selfish, self-centered alcoholic, thinking it would be good for me, I agreed. But I'm so glad that I bought what he told me that night about service, because it was the beginning of a great experience that is difficult to put into words. It was the beginning of my service. I had an opportunity to go on and serve the state of Georgia as a delegate. And then just recently I've rotated out of serving Alcoholics Anonymous as Southeast Regional Trustee on the board in New York. And it has been a great experience of learning about AA, of watching it work at a worldwide level, and having an opportunity to meet AAs from all over the world. And it has just been a great, great experience that I will be forever grateful for. Our youngest daughter got involved with drugs. She left home for a while, came back full-fledged drug addict. We had to kick her out of the house. We packed her up in two garbage bags and put her on the street. Our life had become trying to find our stuff. You know, we live on Memorial Drive, and there's pawn shops all up and down, and we spent most of our time going to the pawn shops trying to get our stuff back. So we finally put her out on the street after a lot of pain and a lot of counseling with Al-Anon and AA people. And she said it was the beginning of her recovery. She got to Narcotics Anonymous shortly after that, and when she had an opportunity to pick her chips up, she said it was the beginning when her mother and father kicked her out of the house and put her on the streets. And she went to NA for 5 years. She doesn't go today, and I think she may be in a little bit of trouble, but she knows where the answer is. She's been there. The last thing that I'd like to really share with you, which has just been a wonderful miracle for me, I told you I was a jazz pianist, and I really thought the opportunity for me to work and express my talents would never be available to me, because if you're a jazz pianist, you know where you have to go to work. So I didn't know whether that would be in the cards for me. I tried to do it when I first got sober, and it didn't work. I had an agreement with my sponsor that if I could handle it, because I love that whole scene. I love the bar. I love the clinking of the glasses. I love the music. I love the candlelight. You know, alcoholism was a real total picture for me, and it began to bother me, and I had to let it go. But then shortly, about 7, 8, 9 years ago, I wanted to go back and try to do it again. And I had the backing of my sponsors and the backing of my sponsorees and my family. And I went down and auditioned at the Jazz Club in Underground, and I've been working there ever since. And it's just been a wonderful experience. I just thought it would never be possible. But, you know, all things are possible when you're sober and when God is in your life. I am so grateful that I've had the opportunity to be with you. I wish you the best. I just would like for you all to get real active in your home groups, get elected GSRs, DCMs, delegates, and get your voice up in New York, because you are the future of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I want to... There's something that's real important for me, because I know that there's so much more to this thing than just not drinking. And this is my favorite thing written about AA, and it's written by Bill, and it's called In All Our Affairs. The chief purpose of AA is sobriety. We all realize that without sobriety, we have nothing. However, it is possible to expand this simple aim into a great deal of nonsense so far as the individual member is concerned. Sometimes we hear him say, "Sobriety is my sole responsibility. After all, I'm a pretty fine chap except for my drinking. Give me sobriety and I've got it made." As long as our friend clings to this comfortable alibi, he will make so little progress with his real-life problems and responsibilities that he stands in a fair way to get drunk again. This is why AA's 12-step urges that we practice these principles in all our affairs. We are not living just to be sober. We are living to learn, to serve, and to love. And I love you a whole bunch, too. Thanks.
Let's have time, I'd like to ask Kelly to come up and introduce Pat W.
Hi, I'm Kelly, alcoholic and drug addict.
Hey, Kelly. Love you, Kelly. Lots and lots and lots. And whole bunches.
Back at you. Let's see. I saw Pat, I guess, a few times at the Howe Place, and the first time that I really met him was back in November. He was doing some talks about the first 164 pages of the Big Book, and I remember that after the talks were over, there were probably an hour and a half on both those Sunday nights until, you know, 11:30 or 12 o'clock at night. Where he brought in all the memorabilia and the pictures and the things and told the stories about, you know, the old days, you know, way back in the beginning about Phil W. And you know, and that kind of enthusiasm still leads Pat today. Every time he walks into the Howe Place, he shakes every hand that's there, and that amazes me, you know, to this day. I've seen, you know, probably the Howe Place with easily 200 people in it, and Pat shake every hand there, you know, at 37 years sober. You know, he's been sober almost 10 years more than I've been alive. That's amazing. With that, I give you Pat W.
I'm Pat W. and I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Pat.
And I don't want to be. Nick just said, oh, took off my coat, because he knows one of the first things I'm going to do is probably nail him. It's been my good fortune to live for 13,593 days without a drink of liquor or any pocket rockets or funny cigarettes or anything else. And that's 37 years and 2 days and 18 months. I want to make a few remarks before I get into my talk. You know, I've got a helicopter coming to pick me up at 5, so I hope you're all comfortable. I want to tell you something. First, Charles back here. Charles is taping. He's the taper here. And he's got all these tapes for sale, so you need to buy them. And you always mention the taper's name, Charles Duggar, on the tape, and you get better fidelity reproduction, you know, when he makes your tape. Gay talked about her service. I hope you all understand that she's just completed a 20-year commitment. 20 years in service to the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, representing us all over the state, all over the country, and all over the world. And that deserves a hell of an applause. I'd like to thank the committee for its invitation. And I can assure you there's AAs out in front of me that are probably give a better talk than I will this morning. Nick, he's the only guy I know that when he gets up to pee at 2 o'clock in the morning, you know, he goes out into the refrigerator for a glass of milk, and when the light hits him, he gives a 20-minute talk, you know. And we got Kyle. You know, I've had the privilege to watch this committee, you know, for probably about 60 weeks. They met every week. Every Friday night they met, without exception. Guys like Scott and Carl and Heather. Nick was there twice, you know. And all of the others that were there every week, you know. And I was so excited about this weekend. And there is no constructive criticism, you know. All criticism is destructive. But I want to take a minute to criticize the AA community in Atlanta, and I'm part of that. I think they did a poor thing this weekend by not showing up to this thing right here and not supporting this GIGIPA conference that's here in Atlanta. There's probably 5,000 AAs within 5 miles of this hall that aren't here, that felt it more convenient to be wherever they are and doing whatever they're doing. But I'm critical of that. I think they should have been here. And you may not think so, but I do. Carl out there, you know, a lot of people don't know, Carl used to be a wrestler. He was an Olympic wrestler, you know. And he was on the American team and he was training for the fight. And his greatest competition was this Russian. They called him Ivan the Terrible. And what he would do is he would get somebody in a, he'd get them all contorted up and put them into a sleeper hold. And what would happen is they would fall asleep and he'd pin them and he'd win the match. While the American coaches were coaching Carl and they really emphasized, you know, fighting this guy that had this sleeper hold. And finally the big night came and Carl got in the ring, you know, and in about 2 minutes, this Russian has got him in this sleeper hold. And Carl's about to be pinned and all of the coaches are walking out, you know, and they're disgusted. And all of a sudden, there's a huge ovation, you know, and they turn around, and Carl's got this Russian guy pinned, you know. So he gets back to the dressing room. They want to know how it happened. You know, how were you able to break? Nobody's ever been able to break that sleeper hold, you know. And he said, well, I was laying there, and this guy had me pinned, and I was almost asleep, and I opened my eyes, and I saw a pair of balls. He said, and you never know your own strength until you bite your own balls. You know, I used to say at meetings that the most important person in this room is the new man after me. But I think the most important person in this room this morning is sitting in your chair. That's the most important person. It has to be the most important person, you know. And I got notes here, like, mine aren't typed like Dick's were. And I want to tell you, all three of us here today, I think all three of us, I don't want to get personal, but we're bona fide old-timers, at least I am. And to be a bona fide, I went up to speak at, I didn't go up there to speak, I went up there to share in Tom Iveser's 40th birthday, and they asked me to say a few words. And I told him that Tom was a bona fide old-timer, because I do know a few things personal about him. First, you have to not die. Second, you have to not drink. Third, you have to have a little gray in your hair, you know. And fourth, you have to have a bad case of hemorrhoids. Now, you all know what, you know, not drinking and not dying is. And the gray, you know, is to look a little bit distinguished. And the bad case of hemorrhoids gives you that look of grave concern. I saw some people get up here today that weren't too dressed up. When I came into AA, it was a different story. They told me, first, they called it the five S's. First is show up. You know, make a commitment, show up. And then you suit up. You suit up. You set an example. Then you stand up so people can see you. You speak up so they can hear you. And when you get through, you shut up when you're done, you know. And I want to tell you, if you get done listening, before I get done talking, you can leave, you know. Because a lot of people have walked out on me, you know. They didn't leave me much time. How much time do I have, Charlie? 45 minutes? Yeah, right. 15 minutes. I got sober at a good time, too. There were a lot of, Gay talks about her old-timers, There were a lot of old-timers back then. He was 24 years old when I got sober today, 62. You know, it's been through a lot of transition. And there's probably nobody in this room except myself that met Bill and talked to him and shook hands with him and hugged him and stood next to him and listened to him share. And I was sitting with my daughter and my current ex-wife the other night, and she told me, she said, "Dad, now don't tell him." You know, she started telling me what not to tell you. And I said, "Well, Amber, how do you know?" I said, "You're 20 years old. You're not an alcoholic. How do you know what they want to hear?" You know? And she said, "I just know young people, you know." But I said, "I'm going to tell them. I'm going to tell them because I think they need to know, you know." And she told me, "Be sure to tell them that the most important person in the room is sitting in their chair." Well, I did do that, you know. But she doesn't like me telling the story, I guess. And I don't know why. Part of it, I guess, is because she's not an alcoholic. She doesn't really understand gut level, you know, what this thing is. Telling a gal this morning, she left. She knew I was going to tell the story, so she left. But I had the privilege of going to Akron, Ohio in 1960 for the 25th anniversary of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was Founders Day, you know, and they expected Bill to be there. And you have to understand, I got sober when I was 21, so I know what it's like to be a young person. I know what it's like to be a one of five people in a 100-mile radius under 25, because I was one of them. And if one of them had to get sober and stay sober, I'm glad it's the one it was. That's me, you know. But I had this privilege of going to Akron, and I'd been told that sometimes he was there and sometimes he wasn't. But I figured, you know, 25th year, you know, a quarter century, he'd probably be there. And we got there on a Friday, and we were probably in a hall, not quite this big, maybe a little deeper, not quite as wide. And we were sitting kind of three-quarters of the way back. My sponsor was here, and there was a friend we knew right in front of us from Chicago. And three men walked like from a door in the corner there. They walked in, they walked to the center, and we were sitting on pews. And the play, A Lady on the Rocks, I don't know whether anybody's familiar with that, it was a real famous play back in the early 60s of a woman who got sober. And they were up there putting it on, and these three guys walking in, and they're walking right down the center aisle. And what Amber didn't want me to tell you is there was an immediate electrification in the room when this guy walked in. And Frank Lola, the guy from Chicago, turned around to Wally, who was my sponsor, and he said, "The guy in the middle is Bill." And I want to tell you that you could feel the energy emanating off of this guy. You could just feel the charisma, and he wasn't a charismatic man, but you could feel the energy coming out of him. And they sat down behind us, and then afterwards, the whole room just lined up just to touch him, you know. And he was 65 years old at that time. And I heard him seven times that weekend. I was able to listen to him share. You know, you read about some of the stuff that's in the books and how fantastic it is and how much it reaches into your heart and soul. Just think if you could have met him. Jay talked about the last resort. He used to call this the fellowship of a second chance. We are people who are living on borrowed time, you know, and I never believed I'd live past 25, and I just celebrated 59 years, 34 years on borrowed time, due to this program. due to the actions and the attitude that I was able to acquire through the application of 12 things I didn't even understand. I was just told to do them, whether you understand them or not. Just do them, and things will happen. And they did. So I was able to be with Bill two more times. I was sharing with her again this morning about being in Maple Leaf Gardens in Toronto in 65. There were 20,000 people standing up. Gave him a 15-minute standing ovation. And he kept telling them, sit down, shut up, sit down, shut up. And they wouldn't. I mean, he just electrified audiences where he was because of who he was. And I remember the introduction at the 60 convention. He said, seldom have so many owed one human being, you know, their life. And I feel that way. I felt that way then, and I feel that way today. I remember I went to a convention in Louisville to hear Clancy. He was coming to Louisville, and he talked on Sunday afternoon, so I had to stay for the whole convention from Friday night, listen to all the speakers. And one guy was a pigeon of Dr. Bob's, and he said that Dr. Bob had real long fingers. He was a rectal surgeon, you know. He had them long fingers. And he used to get people in the corner and sit on a chair backwards, and he would poke them in the chest and tell them that this is a life-changing proposition. Can anybody identify with that? A life-changing proposition. I don't think there's very many things that Chamberlain said that I have left from grade school except the multiplication table, you know. Everything else they taught me is different. Everything else they've taught me has had to change, you know, in order for me to survive today. I think I'm going to... I didn't tell you much. I was an obstinate, angry, fighting, sneaky drunk, you know. There's no other way to put it. My mother and father drank. My mother probably from the time she got up till she went to bed. It was not a problem for me to drink. I saw it all the time. It was not a problem when I had blackouts because they had them, you know. And I just felt it was one of the problems of getting overserved, you know. So I am one, you know. I am one. That's all I'm going to tell you, you know. And I went through a process of getting into a lot of trouble in a very short period of time. I went into service early, got out early, and by the time I was 20 years old, I had an uncle who was sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. He got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. How fortunate are we, you know, that we come in contact with the people we need to come in contact with. I mean, there were 200,000 people in the world in Alcoholics Anonymous, and one of them is an uncle of mine, you know. And he carried the message to me and took me to my first meeting. And my life has never been the same. I have never lost the enthusiasm, the vitality, the animation that I received at my first AA meeting. I've never lost that. And I've been going around AA all over the country, starting things and leaving them, and a lot of them are still going. A lot of that stuff is still going. And, you know, on some cold nights, sometimes it makes me warm to think about, you know, this thing, you know, if you ever knew the story of how AA started, the series of coincidences, I mean, absolute, unbelievable coincidences that put this thing together, there's no way we could be here this morning. No way we could be here this morning, you know. And I remember I was telling somebody last night, and she's there. Hi, Paula. I was sitting with Chuck and Elsa Chamberlain in a Steak and Shake after he had talked at the Illinois State Convention, and he said, "Son," he said, "if you could see what you're involved in here, it would absolutely blind you, because the power in this program is so magnanimous, it's beyond description." And I believe that today. I believed it then when he told me. But I'm happy that Nick, I'm sure, germinated the idea, and Carl and Scott put it into action and got this conference in Atlanta. I'm real happy to have been able to participate. Since Friday night, I heard Christy, heard Bill last night, and a couple of the other speakers, and the energy here. You know, Gary Lundy, God rest his soul, committed suicide with 17 years of sobriety. Used to say, if you could take a wire and hook it up to everybody's mind, you know, after about 12 people, the energy would be so astounding with all the shit that's going through our head, you know, that, you know, you couldn't hook up anymore, you know, be like an atomic bomb, you know. But I want to close. Joe Phelan, God rest him, bless him. He's having all kinds of problems. If he'd have been here last night, I wouldn't have won the, I won the countdown. If he'd have been here, Lucille, sick, she's sick, I wouldn't have won, because they have 44 and 48 years of dedication to the program and the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was talking to Bill last night, friend, one of the first young people I met when I came into AA, guy, 40 years old. He was sober 15 years. He got sober at 25 in 1947, and Bill just went to his birthday last week. He's sober 50 years. Paul Martin, he's talked a couple times in Atlanta. And I should have Amber here. Amber knows what I'm going to say next, and if I forget, she'll prompt me, you know. But I wanted to say something about honesty. And, I was talking about Joe Phelan. I was going to close. I just give you this little tidbit about honesty. I heard it years ago. I used to say my sponsor told me, but I don't think Wally was that smart. He never told me. He really never told me this. And I finally determined where I heard it, and Gay's probably familiar with Don Nicholson, who's a great AA, was a confidant of Bill's, and gave Bill some ideas of the concept when he was writing the concept. Got sober in 48, and Don said, honesty is the absence of all intent to deceive, period. It don't matter what else you try to meld into that, how you want to slice it down, you know. It's the absence of all intent to deceive. And if I'm doing things or saying things or, you know, participating in things that I can't talk to God about, I better find out what the hell's happening. I better find out what I'm doing. I better find out what I'm saying, you know. But anyway, I asked Joe one time. I said, "Did you ever meet Bill?" I figured, you know, shit, he's sober 12 years, 10 years, 11 years longer than I am. He lived 11 years longer. You know, Bill lived 21, 22 years while Joe was sober. Certainly had to meet Bill. He said he never met him. But he was drunk one night. And in the back of a hall up in Massachusetts, and Bill was the speaker. And the only thing Joe remembers about the meeting is that Bill said, "People often ask me what I want for Alcoholics Anonymous, what I want for its future." And he held up his right hand and he said, "What I want is a long line of my brothers and sisters going back to the Father." God bless you, and thank you very much.